Next case is 97-1022, State of Ohio versus Adamson. We'll wait till counsel's ready. Ms. Holder. Didn't anybody at that original time advise her of the 601B2? I mean, that's inconceivable. Not the judge, not the prosecutor, not the defense counsel. Just let her go ahead and testify.
That's right. In fact, we're looking to raise on appeal. I think it was on the issue of the great side of the appeal. The reverse of the case, we're back to where we were, and as far as the witness, we called him on retrial,
if we rule for you, doesn't it put in the hands of the prosecution almost sole discretion when immunity will be given and when we will take it away? The prosecutor giveth and the prosecutor taketh away. Praise be the name of the prosecutor.
Well, the sole reason for the immunity statute is to provide a tool to the prosecutor for law enforcement purposes.
But you granted her immunity.
Did you also did order her to testify upon her immunity? The statute says that the order of immunity to be protected, there has to be a client. That's the issue that we're asking the court to decide. What is the client? I decided a case dealing with the is not the prosecutor.
Did you discover anything after all this testimony went on that then brought you to the point of indicting her for murder? Why didn't you indict both she and her husband at the start?
Well, this case has gotten quite convoluted. Originally, this case was with the Brown County Prosecutor's Office. Now I'm a special prosecutor with appointment on the trial, and now I'm a special prosecutor on the appeal. I have a lot of decisions made. I do know that in speaking to special prosecutor who talking the indictment against the particular defendant, that no evidence was learned upon her testimony, which he can use against her own trial.
Okay, wouldn't it lead one to believe that something occurred connected with her testimony that makes you later indict her for murder? If she was a clear suspect at the start, you should have indicted both, not you. The people involved should have indicted both of them.
I think the only thing that occurred was that she refused to cooperate with
her. That's the answer, isn't it? You didn't do what we told you to do, and therefore we're going to indict you.
It shouldn't be up to the witness to decide whether to find her or not. This situation can occur in any case.
The problem, one of the things we're faced with is the language of the statute. That, I mean, the whole thing is results from a statute, the language of which presents a couple hurdles, one raised by your opposing counsel here, in that, you know, the statute is explicit. I know it uses the word compliance, but then it speaks to the remedies for failure to comply. One of which is not among those is the revoke the immunity. I also wonder about the scenario where you have an otherwise competent witness who this same scenario plays out. but otherwise competent, who refuses in the second trial to testify and has already been granted immunity. What about that scenario?
Well, none of the sanctions would apply in this case. The contempt would not have been, not been able to say to you that testimony in this particular case. Now, and another witness that may be true. Again, I go back to what Trump is trying to find. It shouldn't be up to the witness to determine whether to testify or not.
But the order of the trial court was testify. Answer these questions. She did. I understand the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did it in the first trial.
That's right.
Well, right. But the argument is that the order was answer the questions. This witness did. The fact that the case was brought back through, you know, arguably an error by the prosecution and or the trial court in the first trial, she still technically she did what was ordered. And in terms of comply. Right. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
No question. No question it's worked to her benefit.
Of Ms. Adams. So, I would say first, the case from the point of view that the agency was never properly given by the court because she was
but she wasn't correctly advised of all of her rights. How can the immunity, you're picking one aspect that's favorable to you and overlooking the fact that she was not advised that she did not have to testify. How can immunity be effective under those circumstances?
Well,
that's
that question this way.
She was not properly advised. Whether the ultimate blame lies with the court, who has ultimate responsibility during the course of the trial. How can we have effective, I will underscore that, how can we have effective immunity when it was not properly legally given in compliance with all of the statute and rules?
Well, I go back to what I said earlier about this argument. It's not that I think the word is really operative here, that you need to describe the situation. She had to testify. She had to testify by the judicial order. I would also submit that I think the order may not be void, but the order. And I don't know if that's been questioned on appeal by the city as a basis of occurrence for appeal's decision. So I would argue that given the fact that she had to, by order, testify, then irregardless of the literary, procedural irregularities or deficiencies in the provision, is it relevant?
If we reach your cross appeal, and if we decide favorably on your cross appeal, we never get to the issues we're talking about here, do we?
That's true.
So maybe you'd like to say a little bit about your cross appeal.
Sure. If I may, just say briefly, Ron, before I go into that. A question was brought up during opposing counsel's presentation concerning how you define your compliance. Well, I would submit that the higher courts have already done that. State versus Messina, which is, I believe, a college decision from the 9th district, basically answered that question. In fact, in that case, was the receiver was alleged to have lied. Therefore, the prosecutor went back and tried to revoke the immunity. The court said, really, we don't care if he lied. He testified. And Ms. Addison testified in the first trial. The immunity is going to be irrelevant. With respect to the prosecutor, Your Honor,
may I ask just one more thing then? In the forgetting this scenario where we have this whole business of the witness having been incompetent, in the next case where we don't have the issue of competence and a witness is granted immunity, case is retried, witness then refuses, having already been granted immunity, what do you see as the appropriate remedy? Can the court compel that witness again? In that the immunity's already been granted, so there's no quid pro quo in the second trial, is there, counsel?
The witness, the purpose of immunity, of course, the state argues the purpose of immunity is to further law enforcement goals. The actual purpose of immunity is to overcome the proper invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege and self-determination. Once that occurs, the court grants immunity. The witness is on par with any other witness. If they don't testify, they can and should.
But the court can't grant immunity. The witness already has immunity, has been granted immunity for that testimony. So in the second trial, where are we?
Yeah. You testify, witness, or you're going to jail.
So now you're back to the purpose was to get the testimony as opposed to, you know, more to the same argument that the state makes, that the goal here is to get the testimony as opposed to the compulsion. What is the court using at that point? The statute says, you know, if someone exercises their Fifth Amendment rights, the court may compel and grant. Here, the witness already has immunity, or is it gone?
The witness has, once they're granted immunity, being intent,
it lasts forever, right?
It lasts forever, and that's what the statute says.
So how can a court make you testify the second time when that forever immunity? What's the court offering you at that point?
Well, I don't think it's a question of offering. I mean, a person has one of the cases that I cited.
It's just that they don't, there's no reason not to, they have to testify. They
right.
can be compelled on contempt.
Exactly. It's not a question of the court giving somebody something. It's a question of the court having to recognize natural, inalienable constitutional right, which existed before the Constitution, the rights, the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. It simply recognizes that natural right. So in this case, the court witnesses on par with any other witness the court could have held a testimony, which the court could not therefore do.
In this case, though, Secretary Trump, as she did, she said, I am his wife, and I'm going to testify. Does the court have to deal with the court then?
Of course, my argument would be, Your Honor, that's a tough question. My argument, or my reply to that, Your Honor, is that she waived it by testifying in the court.
But she didn't know she had the right to waive.
Well, I was not her trial counsel, in case anybody was curious.
The point is that now the court has lost its tool to make her testify, that its tool was you could waive yourself a privilege to testify or you could be indicted. The second trial, the court doesn't even have contempt left because it's not going to be
charged. Of course, the issue of waiver was not considered well in the time brief. I would go back to my fallback position, Your Honor, the fact that she was granted immunity, she did testify, but she otherwise would not have to do. The state judicial system, if you will, for lack of a better term, truly is sovereign from my first order on the conflict of prosecution. With respect to my prosecutor, Your Honor, the 1995 amendment to Criminal Rule 12J on its face was a substantial departure from prior practice. By rule. Criminal Rule 12J has always been understood to be the means by which the prosecutor can appeal interlocutory decisions of the trial court granting motions to return the seized property or suppress evidence. When that rule was changed, the substantive language of that rule in 1995 now stated when the state takes an appeal is provided by law. Well, law certainly must be a statute. In this case, the state sought to appeal granting the motion to dismiss in this case by the trial court pursuant to Proviso Section 2945-67.
None that specifically provide for appeal as of right where there's a dismissal of all or any part of the indictment.
Yes, Your Honor. And that, of course, puts it within the gambit, if you will, the ambit of Rule 4, which deals with appeals of right. The only listed appeal in that case is, I think, the prosecution's 12J is specifically listed in it, which states that the appeal has to be taken within 7 days. The state did not do that in this case. So naturally, having been a prosecutor and having taken criminal 12J appeals before, as soon as I looked at this, the parent had then heard the lawyer also reach the same conclusion. This has been a substantive change in the wording of this rule, and that is jurisdictional. Cases that I've cited from this court are that the 12-day appeal is not taken within the time limit, it's jurisdictional, period.
Is 12J and .67, are they mutually exclusive?
I don't think so, because rules govern statutes.
Okay. Well, rules govern statutes if they're in conflict.
I think this would...
How do we get to the point of having an appeal as of right under .67 and never going any other place?
I would suggest that the rule of statute, I think, is the interpretation that you're suggesting is that this is a greater 30-day appeal under the appellate rule 4.
Yes, sir.
I would suggest that given the substantive change in the language of the rule, it is a conflict because law is all unknown. When I first read this, not to interject my personal opinion, I couldn't believe that the rules committee did not intend to change the type of appeal that was subject to 12J. Because before, it had always been understood and very clear that these types of appeals are only for those two categories, return of seized property and motions to suppress evidence.
So is it your position then that the state would never have a 30-day appeal right under 67?
I think logically I have to take that position. And I think that may seem not fair, inequitable. But nonetheless, it's the language of the rule. Because I think it's a matter of logic. And of course,
if we'd hold for your cross appeal, we'd have to end up by saying when the prosecutor gets an adverse ruling, they better run over to the Court of Appeals and file a notice of appeal.
Yeah, I'm not so sure, Your Honor, that would not be under the present rule. I understand there's some there's a move to change the rule. But of course, we're playing, that's in the middle of the game here. We're playing a game with the rule that was enacted in 1995. I guess the way I would answer the question is that part of the impetus for Criminal Rule 12J is that when the state suffers an adverse result, which is going to basically destroy the case, we force them to move forward quickly, in part at least, so the defendant can get on with their life. Well, with the policy reasons, should be really no different with respect to the motion to suspect. Because the defendant wipes the brow and says, thank goodness, I'm done with this. The case has been thrown out, never had merit. We should still force the prosecutor to go forward as quickly as possible. There are policy reasons which justify that conclusion.
Anything else, sir?
Just very briefly, if I may, Your Honor. In my brief, I've cited Wisco Section 29.114, the rules of construction, specifically with respect that statutes which provide for penalties against defendants must be strictly construed. What the state is doing is they are suggesting an interpretation of the immunity statute, which is going to work like a penalty against Ms. Adams. Therefore, that statute must be strictly construed. And strict construction of the statute states that you read it and you see that it is analogous to a contract which the state has wanted to make this case into. A contract case. She wrote the contract. The statute, Your Honor, is the contract. And subsection C, which provides for holding the immunized witness in contempt, enforces the clause. The other thing I would suggest to the court is briefly before I conclude. With respect to Criminal Rule 12J, I submit on Ms. Adams' behalf that a construction of that, or a rather a interpretation which essentially adopts the rule of advisory committee's effort right now to change it, would amount to the next post facto interpretation of that rule, which I believe is unconstitutional with respect to Ms. Adams. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Save 7 minutes of your time.
In response to Jessica's question about whether the next witness, I think if you write the rule that grant immunity is permanently unknowable, that witness can choose in front of the trial not to testify, and no amount of contempt would change that. In this case, contempt is not possible because her testimony still would have been incompetent in accordance with the evidence of 601. So that would not possible. To 12J appeal requires certification by the prosecutor that the case has been made weak by the failure to comply with evidence of the movement of the trial court. This is not a 12J case. No certification is required to be submitted outright by an actual trial court. I think when you have an ambiguous change to a rule, you have to look at the purpose. The purpose of the change to a rule. In this case, the 1992 amendment to the Public Rule 4 and the 1995 amendment to the Criminal Rule 12 were specifically to change certain procedural things and not to make substantive changes to the state's right to appeal. And of course, we that in determination.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted. We'll take it under advisement and we'll render our opinion shortly. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.